Welcome to Diverse Voices Book Review. I'm Hopeton Hay. My guest is Tara Green, author of Love, Activism, and the Respectable Life of Alice Dunbar Nelson. She is also the author of See Me Naked, Black Women Defining Pleasure During the Interwar Era. She is a professor of African-American and African Diaspora Studies at the University of North Carolina at Greensboro, where she teaches gender studies and literature courses. Alice Dunbar Nelson was born in New Orleans in 1875 to a mother who was formerly enslaved and a father of questionable identity. Alice Dunbar Nelson was a pioneering activist, writer, suffragist, and educator. And Tara, welcome to Diverse Voices Book Review.
Thank you. I'm so happy to be here.
Tara, this has to be quite a journey for you to discover her writing while attending the beloved Dillard University in New Orleans, to discover her writing while attending undergrad there, and then to journey to the point where you actually write a book about this incredible, amazing woman that not enough people have heard of. So talk about how you first discovered her writing and how that led you to this journey.
Well, in a classroom at Dillard University, I was an English major, so she was a part of an anthology that we were assigned to read various works in that anthology. And one of the works was a short story by her. I can't even remember which short story it was, actually, but I remember how the short story made me feel being in New Orleans in the 1990s and reading about a New Orleans from her perspective in the late 19th century.
So she was a multi-talented writer, activist, suffragist, and she published, I believe, her first book when she was 19 years old?
Yeah, she was about 20 years old when she published her first book. And that first collection of work, which includes short stories and poetry, caught the attention of the man who would become her first husband, Paul Laurence Dunbar.
Was that Violets and Other Tales?
Yes.
What's the name of that book? And there was a really good poem in there called At Eventide. I don't know if you can talk a little bit about it, but one of the things that you wrote is how her short stories critique ideal domesticity. And the end of that poem is pretty interesting because doesn't hit the usual points that romantic type of poems hit.
I'm not remembering the specifics of that poem. Do you have?
Oh, absolutely. So she wrote to him and told him all her heart and begged of him to come back to her. For fame was but an empty bubble while love was supreme and the only happiness after all. And now she waited while the crimson and gold of the west grew dark and gray and lowering. Nay, be not deceived. I loved you once, but that love you killed in its youth and beauty, leaving me to stand and weep alone over its grave. I came tonight not to kiss you and to forgive you as you entreat, but to tell that you, I have wed another. What a shocking ending.
Right. And so there are times, and I think that poem is an example of this, when we see a woman expressing or taking agency. So she had choices. So we see that. But she also, in that collection, I believe, wanted to also show that women, because this was during the New Woman's era as well, and so that women may have been interested in having jobs and doing work outside of the home as she was doing, because she was a single woman, so she wasn't married at the time, and doing work outside of even her profession as an educator was extremely important to her. But she was also letting the public know that just because women worked and had desires, professional desires, did not mean that they did not have romantic desires. And so she plays with that throughout that early work, most certainly.
So at that point in time in our history or social history, the expectation for women was that their desire or the expectation was for them to be married and have a husband and that at that point in time, you couldn't really love work and love a husband at the same time?
No, you could not. In fact, in some places, as I discussed in the book in Washington, D.C., it was once a woman was buried, it was illegal for her to continue to be a teacher, which was one of the professions that a woman could pursue. And that, of course, she did through her education at what is now Dillard University. So working outside of the home, this is why women didn't have voting rights, because that meant that they would be able to exercise a choice in their thinking, and that that choice may be disruptive to their husband in some way. So whether a woman was married or not, whether she had children or not, she was always thought of as someone who should be preparing for a spouse and to be a mother, or she should be by a certain age.
Now, Alice Dunbar was born in 1875, so she comes in as an adult toward the end of the 19th century and crosses into the 20th century. But her marriage to Paul Lawrence Dunbar, the term I'm going to use, was incredibly tumultuous. So mm-hmm. we had these great intellects and just incredibly tumultuous relationship. Talk about how that may have affected Alice Dunbar's view.
Well, certainly she went into a relationship with him, and I'm saying a relationship, not a marriage, a relationship believing in love, believing that they together would be this formidable couple as two writers. Paul Lawrence was very much revered for his talent as a poet, which she very much so respected herself, and he respected her work also. He was also a fiction writer. Well, she was also a fiction writer. So they had so much in common, and their connection on the creative plane was certainly an attraction for both of them. But she was an educated woman, he was not. So they did not meet in the middle on that. She did not get support from him for the professional goals that she had. She really was a lifelong learner. Either she was in working on postgraduate certificate of some kind or taking courses, or she was just constantly reading throughout her life. But certainly during the time in which she was in relationship with him as well. And that was just something that he was not necessarily doing or necessarily supportive of her advancing herself in that way. And so, you know, that was part of the turmoil that they experienced. Certainly it was an imbalance of power between the two, which was very common during this time between men and women. And then, of course, there's the assault that she would experience before and during marriage as well.
So one of the themes of the book, at least in my mind, is the politics of respectability. And I remember reading a book on the history of Black women in the United States. But this book was the first time I had it really caught my attention, the politics of respectability, though I had heard W.E.B. Du Bois talk about it before. But this notion, as African-Americans tried to get equality with white America, that they felt that they had to stick to the Victorian ideals. And I'm going to do in quotation mark these ideas of morality. And so Alice Dunbar was also caught up into that notion. So she was having to present a public image of respectability. And frankly, that was not just an Alice Dunbar issue. I mean, that was frankly across the board, right? So I don't want to make it sound like Alice Dunbar was the only person who was having to provide this image of respectability. But it didn't really match her true desires in life, her love of both men and women, but she felt the necessity as being part of the movement to present this image.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I certainly see her as somebody who redefines what that may mean. And so that is why I like the way that Evelyn Higginbotham discusses it, which is that there's a public perception, which means that gives space for what happens privately. And so when we think about the life of somebody like Alice Dunbar Nelson, what she did publicly was what the community and the nation needed for her to do. She was dedicated to women having the right to vote. She was dedicated to educating children. And I can go on about that. She was dedicated to stopping the exploitation of young girls, because that morality, there's a clause there. So as I talk about, particularly in the South, and as her own mother may have experienced, there was exploitation of Black girls and women that was grounded in the history of the country. So there has to be some sort of way in which to redeem women and that history, so that women don't fall prey to it, but also that there are some sort of safety measures in place. And so setting up a place where young girls could find shelter once they arrived in New York from the South, where there would have been predators waiting for them once they got off those trains. That was some of the work that she did in protection of Black women. There were other Black women in different parts of the country who had places for women as well. And so, you know, in her own life, where we find that she is in relationships outside of marriage and between marriage with women, or at least with one other man, again, that is her exercising her agency in private. And so however many people knew about that, it certainly wasn't anything that was talked about very much. But this was something that men had been doing all the time. W.E.B. Du Bois, for example, had many relationships with many women outside of his marriage. So we have to clarify. Yeah. And so these are people that are speaking in one way about, you know, thinking about family and the future, because all of it is futuristic, about how they would like to see Black people treated. But that did not mean that they did not have a life, because they certainly did.
And you actually cover, you know, Black women defining pleasure during the interwar era. And you talk about the lives of Lena Horne, Moms Mabley, Yolanda Dubois, and Memphis Minnie, who, as you in the description of the book, enjoy pleasure as they gave pleasure to both those in their lives and to the public at large. And I think, you know, one of the things I think about how we really need to separate the personal life from the civic engagement, the community engagement, because those are really two separate things.
Mm-hmm. Well, for those who wanted to do that, Alice Dunbar Nelson wanted to do that, but somebody like, and that's a different class of Black folks, but somebody like Memphis Minnie, that wasn't her concern. So her personal life is echoed in much of her music. And, you know, she doesn't apologize for that. Why should she? So, but she has a different audience. She's living a different kind of life. She wasn't a part of the educated Black class that was emerging during her day. So, you know, it depended on the woman. And I'm very interested in making sure that we understand Black people and certainly Black women as a diverse group.
So talk about what was it that inspired you most to write this book, this biography of Alice Dunbar Nelson?
Because there was so much work that she and her niece had put into preserving her life. She kept so much, her letters, really starting with her correspondence with Paul Lawrence. He wanted his assistant kept asking for those letters back. She wouldn't return them. So from at least 1895 until the last couple of years of her life, where she wanted to clearly be known, and she did not throw away evidence that told us that she had relationships with women either. And so there are very few Black people whose records are accessible, personal records are accessible to us. Often when people write biographies, they may have, there are very few Black people, period, but that is especially true for Black women. So let me put it that way. So, you know, Mary Church Terrell, there's a lot of material on her. And so then we tend to see more biographies on her. We know that Du Bois, he would send off a letter and he would keep a copy, and we have that even digitized available to us. But Alice Dunbar Nelson was somebody who was in relationship, professional relationship with Du Bois, with Mary Church Terrell, and all of these people, Schomburg, I mean, just so many people. And the only thing that people knew about her was that she had been married to Paul Lawrence Dunbar. And that was her first husband. So this woman had lived an entire life before she was in relationship with Paul Lawrence and after she was in relationship with Paul Lawrence. And we knew very little about any of that. And I wanted to correct that. I just couldn't understand how all of this material could be available to us and so little had been done. In terms of looking at her later work and not just her earlier work, but also looking at the contributions that she had made to our society as a journalist, but certainly as an activist.
The archives at the University of Delaware was your primary source for putting this book together, as I understand. Not your sole source, but your primary source. Yes. And she lived in Delaware. For quite a while.
She did. She lived in Wilmington, Delaware for most of her adult life. She lived in three or four different cities after she left New York. She went to Brooklyn, then she went to Wilmington. And when she died, the last couple of years of her life, she lived in Philadelphia, which is where she passed away.
One of the things you write in the book is you talk about, why did a Creole woman leave New Orleans to marry a dark skinned man? Mm-hmm. And live in Delaware. And the interesting thing was, she could pass for white, mm-hmm. but chose not to pass for white. Mm-hmm. And she actually wrote definitely in some of her fiction stories about where characters were passing and what the impact of them passing was like.
Yeah, she wrote quite a bit about that. And she critiques it heavily because it's not something that she was certainly promoting. The times in which which I know that she passes for white because she'll make these slight references in her diary. For example, to get into the Cotton Club in New York. Well, the only way she could have gotten into that Cotton Club is if they thought she was white. So and clearly the people at the door didn't know she was Alice Dunbar Nelson either, because it's not like she wasn't this famous woman who was knocking on the door at that particular time. So, you know, it's not even something that she states that she's passing for white. It just becomes a reference. And, you know, with the historical information, I'm able to know that she's doing this. But she doesn't live the life of a white woman. She does it to pass into certain places and to pass out of them safely. But she does not live the life of a white woman.
One of the other things, and you mentioned this earlier, was her foray into journalism. Mm-hmm. And her husband started a newspaper in Wilmington, Delaware. And you really chronicle the hardship of trying to build a successful newspaper at that point in time and how hard it was for her trying to be both help with the newspaper, taking care of all the domestic responsibilities. There's also a point where you talk about how she wanted to present the image of financial success and education, even though she was, they were barely getting by and barely, you know, and really, really struggling. So talk a little bit about that difficulty of presenting that image so you could maintain this level of esteem in your white peers with the reality. And once again, this is something that's not unusual for anybody, mm-hmm. But also the challenges she faced with the struggle with trying to build that newspaper.
Yeah, it's almost a kind of social performance that has to go into the politics of respectability. So, you know, Black people are getting the education that they rightly deserve from what we now call HBCUs, of which both of us are graduates. But of course, the futuristic mission was that they would have access, that they would have stability in society and so on and so forth. And it's something that we all still have. My students would tell you that. But for her, it did not mean financial stability at all. She would write in letters sometimes. One I can think of that she kind of jokingly says it to her second husband, whom she kept in touch with until her death after they separated. But at the time she's married to her third husband, she says something about her rags. And I see that over and over and over again in her writing, because she's constantly stitching up her clothes. Now, clearly, these are clothes in which they need to be discarded and replaced, but she doesn't have the money to do that. But these stitched up clothes is what she would wear to some of these very well-known places that we wish that we could have had tickets to. And the only reason why she has tickets to these events is because she is Alice Dunbar Nelson. And so her reputation, not only as the widow of Paul Lawrence, but also because of her ability to be able to speak, because she is writing for these editorials for Black newspapers. So if she's going to an event, it's something that she's probably going to write about. She's probably going to make a connection. Like I said, she had a very good professional relationship with W.E.B. Du Bois. And that comes out of the kind of networking that these Black elite folks had on the East Coast. So, you know, after she gets fired from her teaching job at Howard School, and she hopes that them opening up, which was really her husband's doing, he was always coming up with some sort of scheme that they open up this newspaper that they would be. Yeah, I mean, he was always scheming. He was a hustler, baby. But she was always the one that was kind of paying for these schemes. So she's out there doing this work and hoping that it will bring them some good fortune, that they don't look like so much of a failure to their Black friends and peers and enemies. And that doesn't work out for them. It's not until several years later when he gets a political appointment in Philadelphia, where they're actually able to enjoy financial stability for the first time during their marriage. But before that, they're struggling the entire time because he never has a full-time paying good job. He just doesn't have it.
He's always on the hustle.
Yeah.
But she was also able to build a career as a journalist, writing columns for a number of newspapers. And seems like she was really did a lot of coverage of the Harlem Renaissance. Talk a little bit about how she was able to capture the Harlem Renaissance as a journalist.
When people usually talk about her, they talk about her as a Harlem Renaissance writer. And I take pause because she was a Victorian age writer. She's writing before these younger people come about. And so her real contribution to the Harlem Renaissance is that she's writing about the younger writers and the work that they're doing and some of the political issues that are taking place at the time. But this is where we see her love of drama. We see her love of film as it develops and Black people's engagement with drama and with film, because that's really becoming a place where Black actors and actresses and writers like Oscar Micheaux are able to showcase their abilities. But of course, if it's poetry, she's interested. She writes a couple of columns about Cullen, who was, of course, Du Bois's beloved. There are so many words that I could use for the love that Du Bois had of Cullen, even after the failed marriage between Cullen and his daughter. He was one of the favorites of the Harlem Renaissance, of course, along with Langston Hughes, whom she talks about. So we see all of that reflected in the columns that she writes during a certain period of the Harlem Renaissance.
I was really interested in her relationship with Oscar Micheaux. Talk about how he came to her. She made several pitches to him. She actually wrote a couple of screenplays, and she was pretty honest in her critique of his work in her diary.
Yeah, in her diary. So
yeah, let me say that again. In her diary, right. Not in the columns. She didn't write any negative columns about him.
So it was fun actually reading the diary alongside what she said publicly, which again goes into that politics of respectability. So yes, Oscar Micheaux, and I'm really not sure why he was spending the time that he did in Wilmington, Delaware, but he was just one of many well-known, well-respected Black artists whom she knew and who would visit with her in Wilmington, Delaware. And so he came to the office and they had conversations, and she had hoped that another genre that she could have added to her long resume of writing would be that she could get involved with writing these screenplays. And she did. They're not very good at all. She just really, I prefer her short stories. I think that she mastered that genre. I think that she was very well versed in her journalism, some of her poetry, but certainly not the screenplays are just not her best work at all. So it's not surprising that she is not successful and that the relationship that she tries to develop with Oscar Micheaux in that area doesn't go anywhere.
I want to jump back to her work as an activist, because she was a charter member of the very first branch of the NAACP in Wilmington, Delaware. Mm-hmm. She was an organizer for the suffragist movement for the Middle Atlantic states. She was part of the Black Women's Club movement. So she was involved in a lot of different organizations that were trying to represent the interests of women, as we've talked about earlier, trying to get the vote. Obviously, the NAACP and its anti-lynching campaign, which sort of drove its founding in 1909. So she wrote fiction. She wrote journalism. She was an activist. And I'm curious to think of how you feel all those different interests sort of coalesced into how she ended up being such a, in my mind at least, just a unrecognized, but in my mind, a powerful force in the movement.
She was a powerful force in the movement, and people at the time recognized her as such. It's so, you know, the good and the bad, the pro and the con of Marion Paul Lawrence Dunbar is that she becomes his wife only, and people stop there. So that's good for her because of the work, quite frankly, that she did to keep his name in people's mouths, because she would travel and she would read his work, and she also received royalties. She was the sole person to receive royalties from his work. which was good because she didn't always have any money, right? So, but that reputation also meant that she became a shadow even after his death. And I think that that's sort of the legacy that goes back to your first question, your earlier question about, you know, that you even grew up in New Orleans and did not know about. This was just not a part of the regular curriculum for any of us growing up in that area. So let alone throughout the nation. And so, yeah, I mean, most certainly the work that she was doing was very well known amongst the Black people who were, big names. I've already named a few, but I can go on. I mean, Booker T. Washington, his wife, Mrs. Booker T. Washington, but certainly people knew her during that time. It just becomes later after her death that we don't continue to hear her name.
Well, I want to close with what I think you may think is the most important piece of writing she ever did. And I want you to comment on it. So she co-wrote the Delta Hymn.
Mm-hmm. She did. She wrote.
Now, wait, I got to interrupt. Yeah. You're supposed to laugh because you are a Delta. I served that up for you. Delta Sigma Theta sorority.
Yeah, she was. She was one of the early honorary members, and she wrote the lyrics to the Delta Hymn. So I wouldn't say that that is her most important work. My SARS.
Of course, I said a ton in cheek. Yes. Of course.
Of course. But yeah, and that is something that I did not know when I started my early work. It wasn't until I got into the archives and I said, oh, wait a minute, because there's something in there of that she received as a Delta. And I thought, wait a minute, I didn't know she was actually. And then I went back and looked to see who had written the hymn. I think I may have figured that out in a sorority meeting. These were just things that she had always been present in my life. And at least since Dillard University, because I became a member when I was at Dillard, and I just didn't even know it. Yeah, so I just ended up in the right place at the right time, I suppose.
What year did you pledge?
In 1992, and I graduated from Dillard in 95.
And what's the name of your chapter?
Beta Gamma.
I'm a Alpha Phi Omega fraternity brother, pledged in 1980. I think it was 1980.
Mm-hmm. Good.
So how can people find you on social media and your website, Tara?
www.drtaratgreen.com.
And on social media?
Twitter? I'm on Twitter, Dr. TT Green, and I'm also on Instagram, TaraT.Green.
Dr. Tara T. Green, author of Love, Activism, and the Respectable Life of Alice Dunbar Nelson, thank you so much for being a guest on Diverse Voices Book Review.
Thank you. This was great.
Thank you for listening to Diverse Voices Book Review. I'm Hopeton Hay, host and producer. The theme music is provided by Wright Productions. You can follow the show on social media. Under Facebook and Instagram, it's Diverse Voices Book Review, or Twitter under @DiverseBooksHay.